Welcome to the Healthcare Advocacy Podcast. On this podcast, you'll hear stories to encourage, inspire, and empower you to be the best healthcare advocate that you can be for yourself or for a loved one. The information provided in this podcast is not to be used for any medical advice. This is for information only and to support you in your journey. Please consult with your physician and medical team. In fact, share your favorite episode with your team and ask questions from that.
All right.
There we go.
So welcome so much to the podcast today, Brittany. I'm so glad to have you on.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate being here.
Absolutely. And today we just wanted to learn a little bit about yourself and so go ahead and begin.
Perfect. So my name is Brittany Heckenberg. I am a wife and a mother to four. We live in Arvada, Colorado, and I am a real estate agent, so as a full-time profession.
Excellent. And so I know you've had some interesting stories with all of your children, especially number three,
correct? That's correct. Yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, if you could share a little bit about that experience, just kind of how it all began.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So a little backstory is my husband and I have been married almost 15 years. So that'll be 15 years in August. And so throughout our entire relationship, which we've been together for 19 years, he's always had some type of health issues. And so it's kind of the start of our journey. And so what really kind of transpired the last couple years was our third child, our son Henry, got sick one day. And so our two older daughters had the stomach bug. It was no big deal. They kind of got better after a couple days, and Henry got it. And at this point, we had also just had our fourth. So our fourth little guy was about 5 weeks old at the time. So kind of my mind's a little bit different somewhere else because I have Austin, who I'm taking care of and nursing and all that. And then Henry gets sick and we don't really think it's that big of a deal because the girls were sick and it's fine. So after a couple days, he did not get better and he kept vomiting and wouldn't eat. And so we thought, oh, that's, you know, kind of weird. So on Mother's Day, I had my husband take him down to the hospital. So he goes down there and I'm thinking they're just going to give him an IV because he hasn't really had much in his stomach for the last 48 hours. They get him down there. They look him over, hand him a popsicle. He eats a popsicle and they send him home. And so he comes home and I'm kind of irritated and I'm like, okay, well, if everything's fine, everything's fine. So the next day, I go off to work. I had some appointments in the morning. And Ryan, my husband's home with the boys, and texts me and says, I think something's wrong with Henry. He's throwing up this dark green stuff, and I don't know what it is. And so I'm quickly Googling it. He's Googling it. We're trying to figure all this out. And in the meantime, I call our pediatrician. And it's through a nurse, and I have to leave a message. And it's, you know, not fast enough, obviously. So by the time I get home, which was about an hour and a half later, he's completely lethargic to the point where he can't even hold his head up. He has, his color is off, and it was just pure panic in that moment. So he did not look right. So I grab the boys, take them, and I just drive to the hospital. Get there, and they're working on him, and they throw us in a room, and they're coming at me with all different directions. Like they're taking him here and they're doing a scan here and they're taking him here and they're drawing blood and they're doing this. And one of the nurses just looked at me and said, do you not see that? And I thought, see what? I don't know what you're talking about. And she goes, he's completely yellow. And I thought, no, like I don't see that. Like I don't see it. Like I've looked at his little face for the past 2 weeks and no, I don't see it. So he's completely jaundiced. And then once they do the testing, they come back that his hemoglobin was 2.97. So your average is somewhere between 11 and 13. So Henry was in critical condition at this point. And so they said, we don't know what's going on. You're not going anywhere. We're going to take you to the PICU. So they moved us up to the PICU for more testing. And so the long of it was we had a quick diagnosis within the first 24 hours, which turned out to be the wrong diagnosis. And we were sent home. So we got home like the day before his second birthday. So we got sent home. We celebrated at home on his birthday. And then the next day I called the pediatrician because his diaper didn't look right. So while we were in PICU, they were giving him blood and his color was coming back and everything appeared to be great. And then that Saturday morning, something just wasn't right in his diaper. It was this really weird orangey, tingy, black stuff. And I thought, well, maybe it was from the blood for transfusions, like nothing we've noticed before, but I'm just going to take him into the pediatrician. So we get into the pediatrician and he's just like, oh boy, he did a finger poke and said, no, his hemoglobin's low. I'm calling your hematologist. You need to get back to the hospital. So we get back to the hospital. They give him blood and they send us back home and did not even address this whole diaper thing. So I was kind of like, okay, well, that's interesting. So I call the PD, or I call, oh, go ahead. Yeah. No, did you have something? Oh,
exacerbated.
Yeah. I mean, is this crazy? Yeah. So then next day, Sunday, I call the oncologist again, hematologist, and said, hey, look, like we didn't even discuss this whole diaper thing. Like she didn't even come down to the hospital. We just got a blood transfusion in the ER and they sent us home. That's exactly what happened. So I'm like, we didn't even talk about this diaper thing. I don't know what's going on. His diaper still looks really weird. And she just goes, oh God, it's his kidneys. Get him in. And I'm like, oh my God. So then we rush him back down and he was in full kidney failure. And so that sparked our stay. So we stayed in the hospital trying to figure out why he was hemolyzing for 40 days. And so within that 40-day window, we had three different diagnoses. The first one was a cancer diagnosis, which, to be honest, I was kind of excited about because I figured we could do a bone marrow transplant because that's one of the cures. Thinking we have three other children, we're going to have a match, everything's going to be great. Come to find out, they misread his report, and it was for another patient named Henry that was in his 70s at the adjoining hospital. So that was like, yeah, that was lovely. So that was not Henry. Our Henry, and then they gave us another diagnosis of atypical hemolytic uremic syndrome. So we call it AHOS, which is a terminal complement disorder. And it didn't sit well with me. It was just a weird diagnosis. It's something I'd never ever heard before. And of course, in the meantime, when I keep getting these diagnoses, I'm like Googling everything. I'm joining every Facebook group I can. I'm trying to learn as much as I can about the disease so I can prepare myself for the doctor. And AHOS is like a pyramid per se. And so you have to have kidney failure, you have to have platelets that are wrong, and then you have to have your red blood cells that are being transfused. And he met two of the three, but the platelets, he didn't fit. So this is like the one diagnosis where we fought the whole time. And so we had teams of specialists coming in saying, this is what it is, this is what it is, and we're going to do this. So they gave him a miracle drug called Soliris, and it did nothing. And then they said, don't worry about it. It takes a couple weeks. We're going to give him a second dose. So they do it again, and it did nothing. And now we're 3 weeks in, and nothing is happening except for he's completely dependent on blood. So he was pretty much getting blood every other day, and we were only transfusing at 4.9 or lower. So if he was at a 5, we weren't transfusing. So, and that was just kind of our life. So every other day, he's completely dependent on blood. And finally, we all kind of were like, well, this is definitely not working. Like, we know this isn't working. I had my suspicions very early on what Henry had had, and those were quickly shot down by the doctors. And so, meaning my husband actually has this condition. So my husband has the exact same condition as Henry, and it looked very similar. It presented almost identically, with the exception of my husband would get a Coombs test and it would test positive, and Henry would get his Coombs test and it would test negative. And so this is where I had a battle with the doctors, because they're telling me he's negative Coombs. This is not autoimmune. This is not autoimmune. Da, 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 da.
Can you go back and say what that test is, what that Coombs test stands for, or what that looks like?
Yeah. So with the Coombs, I don't necessarily know what it stands for, but Coombs is basically it's your trigger. It looks at different antibodies in your body, and we each give off different antibodies, and it dictates if this is like an autoimmune issue. And so with my husband, when he gets a positive Coombs test, it's because you have three, I mean, you have a few more, but your three major antibodies are your IgG, your IgM, and your IgA. Your IgG is something that you see almost all the time. So it's a very easy detectable. You can pull it up in a regular Coombs test. It's easy. Your IgM will also pick up in a Coombs test. Your IgA will not ever show in a Coombs test. And so when Ryan would get sick, it was his IgG and his IgM that, I mean, it picked it up in the blood work, said it's autoimmune, give him steroids, do the treatment, we call it good. Well, with Henry, nothing was picking up. There was no IgG and there was no IgM. And so this is kind of where it kept puzzling the doctors. And so it just happened to be, you know, we're now 4 weeks in, and I'm sitting there, and I had a doctor friend who's a pathologist email me this article about autoimmune hemolytic anemia, which is exactly what Ryan has. So autoimmune hemolytic anemia with an IgA antibody. So I'm reading this in the hospital room. Ryan's across from me on his laptop in the hospital room reading another case about this IgA. And our hematologist walks in and she said, I'm completely puzzled, but I think what we need to do is a thing called a super Coombs test to test for this very rare antibody. And I'm like, are you talking about an IgA? And she's like, well, yeah, I'm talking about an IgA. And I'm like, I'm reading about this. And Ryan's like, I am reading about this too. And none of us knew what any other was doing. And I think that was kind of the whole theme, like the entire time Henry's in the hospital, I'm doing my own research. Ryan's doing his own research. And I mean, we must have had 20 prep talks every single day. Like it could be this, could be this, could be this, could be, you know, like constant, like trying to diagnose him. Cause I really thought once we had a diagnosis, our problems would be solved, kind of a thing, you know? And so sure enough, this was, of course, it was a holiday weekend and this happens to be a Friday. And she says, I think the soonest we're going to get these results back is on Wednesday. And we're going to rush them as much as we can, but everybody's out for Monday. And on top of that, there's only two labs in the entire United States that even test for an IgA.
Seriously?
Yes. And so I'm like, okay. So, and then we had to run it through insurance to make sure, you know, insurance. So just one of those things. Mm-hmm. So we're sitting there Wednesday night about 6 o'clock and his phone rings in his hospital room and she gets on and says, we have a positive IgA. Mm-hmm. And so basically what that does for us is it changed the course of treatment. And so what I mean by that is we had this terminal diagnosis where kidney was following us. So our hands were in the hands of all the kidney doctors and the immunologists, because those were the two specialties that specialize in AHOS. And now with IgA, this goes back to strictly autoimmune, and this is blood, and this is hematology. And so by that course, what had happened is, and as we knew, we will do steroids, we'll do IVIG, and then we do, basically, it's like a soft chemo called rituximab. So then we do the Rituxan. And that's how Ryan's been treated the past two times he's relapsed on this. And that's exactly what I prepared the doctors for when we entered the hospital room 40 days earlier. And they said no. I mean, they looked at me, like the immunologist looked at me, and I said, he's going to have autoimmune hemolytic anemia. You're going to give him steroids. You're going to give him IVIG. You're going to give him rituximab. And then none of you are going to ever be able to tell me what happened to him. And the immunologist looked at me and said, ma'am, I didn't get into medicine to not be able to give you an answer of what's going on with your son. Mm. And in one hand, I kind of liked it because he kind of put me in my place. And so it kind of made me feel better. But then on the same hand, I'm like, I was right, kind of a thing. You know, like looking back, I was like, I was right. And why could you not just have dabbled in my thought process, you know? And so that was kind of the path, and that's kind of what happened. And sure enough, that's exactly what it is. He responded a little bit to steroids. We could go every like 2 days for a transfusion and then pause for a day, and then sometimes go 2 or 3 days and then pause and then go two. So it did buy us time. The steroids bought us time. The IVIG was useless to us. It didn't do anything. And then it was the Rituxan that basically came in, killed everything, killed all of his antibodies. And then that's when we were no longer dependent on blood. And then that's when we got released. And then we had treatment every week for 7 weeks.
Yeah. Wow, Brittany. Thanks for sharing that story. I followed it through Facebook, but obviously did not ever get that.
Crazy. Yeah.
I was writing a lot of things down during that, and just to, obviously hindsight is 2020, but the very first thing when you first started talking, the first thing that entered my brain was autoimmune.
Of course. and you know as well as I know, you know, it runs in families. Yeah. I mean, autoimmune is like a finger, right? Like it goes all different directions. And so it is unlikely to have a father and a son have the exact same condition. And that's what they kept saying to us. They said, there's no way he has it. Like, it would be being struck by lightning twice. There's no way Henry can have the exact same thing as your husband.
I mean, autoimmune is very interesting. And then do they think that that illness that your girls had was the trigger for him? Or
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And so, you know, and that's kind of the world we're in now, right? And so at any point in his life, he's going to have a trigger. And the doctors are slightly surprised because he has not yet been triggered and we're 2 years past it. So they were pretty confident this was going to happen within the first year. So they had kind of prepared us within the first year. And then we just made it 2 years in May and they're kind of shaking their heads like, I don't know. And so, and I don't know, and they don't know. And, you know, Henry, to our knowledge, is the first documented case of a two-year-old to have a pure IgA antibody.
Wow.
And the case study I read was of a 18-month-old little girl that had an IgG at level 2, positive 2, with an IgA 5. And so she had IgA in her, but she tested positive on Coombs because she had the IgG. So the treatment looked different. Mm-hmm. And so nowhere could we find an IgA, a pure IgA of 5, you know? So so they don't know. Yeah.
And just because you couldn't see the IgG on the test doesn't mean that it isn't existing in his body somehow. I mean,
absolutely. You know. Absolutely. And that's the piece, you know, he might, upon relapse, you know, he might pop up with an IgG.
Yes. That's so interesting. But what a unique case. And, you know, you as mom and Ryan as your husband to advocate for him and just stand by him and not stop till you found.
Yeah.
Plus taking care of your other children. That must have been very challenging.
Yeah, it was. It was different. I will say that. I mean, I would say, I feel like we had a little bit more adversity coming into it. I mean, I had one doctor in the PICU tell me Austin couldn't be in there with me and she was going to put us on restriction. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, looked at her and I said, you're not effing putting me on a restriction, you know, because in my mind at that point too, my concern was I had a feeling this was autoimmune and I'm nursing. And I'm trying to give him as many antibodies as I possibly could, you know? And so I'm like, don't take that away from me kind of a thing. My parents and Ryan's parents really stepped up and took our older girls, mm-hmm. which was great. You know, I'd be at the hospital from about 5:30 a.m. to about 8 p.m. And reason being is his kidney doctor came in every day at 6 a.m. And then his hematologist oncologist would come in at the very end of the day. And I didn't want to ever miss one of them.
Yeah.
But I tried to get home to see the girls for a few minutes before I put them to bed and then started all over again. Oh, and meanwhile, Ryan stayed at the hospital.
Yeah. That it's an amazing story and the fact that you guys are 2 years after and just doing so well. I mean, congratulations. I'm very happy for
Henry. Yeah, thank you. We are too. We're very happy. We're very blessed. Yeah, we're glad that this is, yeah, a little behind us. But we know that the future's still ahead of us too. So,
right.
Yeah.
So thinking about all of that, and even just this very 40-day period, what do you need to change? Or what could have made this different with our healthcare system?
You know, I think that's the problem. I feel like, and I knew early on, right? I mean, these doctors have hundreds of patients. Mm-hmm. My son is no different, but it was my son. Mm-hmm. It was my son. And so I kind of just wish that at some point they would kind of take you serious or at least offer to help. And our pediatrician doctor in the hospital, the hospitalist, she listened to us so well. Like, she was phenomenal. I mean, she was trying to run tests and then she'd get shot down by the hematologist and she'd get shot down by the immunologist. And I mean, she definitely had a level of care and concern for Henry. And I think that's what I wanted. Like, that's what I wanted in somebody. I just wanted someone not only to advocate, but also just listen to us. And I don't need like a therapist, you know, talking to somebody. I just want, hey, if I come to you with this test, just test him, you know, just test him. And that was one of the things where we kept getting shot down. We would pull stuff up and say, well, can we run this? And can we run this blood panel? And can we run this? And it was constantly, no, that doesn't make sense. No, that doesn't make sense. And so we kind of had, when we realized Solaris wasn't working, truth be told, we had like this come to Jesus moment with the doctors. And I ordered an entire doctor panel where we all sat down and we hashed it all out. And that's when I think they could see Ryan and I visibly getting angry. This is where we could hold them accountable and say, why didn't we look at this? Why didn't we look at this? Why did we wait too long? And they all had an answer to it in front of us. And I think that was the piece that was really helpful for all of us, because as much as you think that the, you know, your kidney doctor and your immunologist and your oncologist are talking and your pediatrician, they're not talking. They're not communicating. Like, they're not communicating. And that's the piece that would leave me so maddened, because they lacked the communication. And you think as a parent or a patient, oh, we're in the same hospital, they have to have this great system, da, 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 da. And there is no system, you know, and it's this person's show or this person's show or this person's show, or this person has more expertise than that person. And so, you know, they all really looked to the immunologist, who was actually not even part of our hospital. He was part of National Jewish. So he was just kind of looking at us as kind of a, you know, like, ooh, this is a kind of a neat family. I'd like to see how this works, you know, kind of from the sideline. But yet he was the one that probably had the most information for all of us. So yeah, I think it really wasn't until that moment when we all got really clear on what the heck we're doing, you know, and that was also our opportunity to prepare and basically give them a list of medications that we thought he could have. We asked about surgery, we asked about splenectomies, and they had to answer us why it was and why it wasn't going to work, you know, and so that, I think it felt better to have everybody in the same room.
And that was your idea? You came up with that idea?
Yeah, it was my idea. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a phenomenal idea. So when we have multiple practitioners, even in the same hospital, even for the same hospital admission, you're absolutely right. We live in silos as healthcare providers. It's very unfortunate. And you're right, there is this kind of hierarchy of who has the power. And you, like you said, your hospitalist was even being shot down by the specialists. And that's unfortunate. So I commend you. That was a very smart move to call that meeting.
Yeah, it really changed the dynamic. And it kind of, you know, we're not the experts, right? I mean, I sell houses for a living. Like, I don't do this, you know? And so this is not my area of expertise. So I do feel like as a parent and as a patient, we really rely on these people to know what they're doing, you know, and we really take their word for what it is. And so you also kind of have to wrestle with, well, they're the expert. I'm sure they know, but you know, it's neither here nor there, but it's one of those things where, yeah.
That's advocate. A very delicate balance. It seems like even though it was frustrating for you, that you actually negotiated that very well.
Yeah.
By feeling empowered to at least even bring up your suggestions.
Yeah. I will say this too. I felt we were not part of the children's hospital system. And I'm not saying one is better than the other by any means, but I had a really good friend who has a good friend who's also a hematologist at Children's. And he was kind enough to kind of talk to me off record, right? And so For me, it was very beneficial. Obviously, he didn't have all of the facts in front of him. Never did he have the facts in front of him. Never did he see Henry's file. But he was very good at planting the seed and telling me what to ask, how to ask, what medicines, you know, all of that stuff. And so I was very grateful for that because it was like having a second set of ears and eyes just to be able to dictate stuff. And, you know, at the end of the conversation, you know, he'd finally had just said, if you don't think they're capable, we're happy to take Henry on as a patient. Just ask for a transfer. And that was kind of in my back pocket too. And that's kind of what I had told these guys too. If you can't take care of him, we're going to want to transfer to Children's and see if we can get a different set of opinions. Mm-hmm. And so I think sometimes you kind of had to light a fire under them. And I'm not saying we would have had a better experience at Children's because frankly, I don't think we would have, but it was still one of those things where there has to be accountability too. There has to be accountability.
Absolutely. That's wonderful that you were able to have that support. So having another person in that healthcare realm kind of outside to kind of bounce ideas off of was crucial for you.
Absolutely.
I don't think a lot of people have that same attitude as far as, or feeling comfortable to have those discussions with the doctors, and I think feel powerless or feel like I don't know what to do. Do you have any suggestions or?
I do. I mean, yeah, I get that. Like I get that. And we've been told that a lot. You know, a lot of people said, well, I just don't know if I would have done what you would have done. And, you know, maybe not. But then I also look at him and I'm like, we had a terminal diagnosis. Our son was to die. Like, what are my chances? And so I just kind of felt like we were in a flight or fight, you know? And neither one of us are just kind of like overly trusting people, I guess. And I feel like it was just one of those things where I had to know what was going on with him. I just had to know what was going on with him. And so it just, there wasn't a second in the day that I wasn't thinking about Henry or this test or that test. And so yeah, it's definitely tough. It's wearing. I mean, it's not, I wouldn't recommend it for everybody, obviously. But it was short-lived. I'm glad that's how we responded to it. And I would just say, like, second opinions are huge. Trust your gut. Like, you know, all that stuff. Like, I mean, I had it in my gut. Like, it was just that instinct, you know? And I think as women, especially, like, we have been blessed with this intuition. And I don't think we listen to it as enough as we can, you know? And that was my whole thing. I'm like, I feel it. You know, I feel something is different. Something is missed, you know, and being able to speak up for that. And it's hard to speak up. You know, it's hard to tell somebody in an authority position that you think they're wrong.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I truly believe we all have that ability to be intuitive, but whether we listen to it, whether we hear that, or we push it to the side. So wonderful for you that you were able to go and keep pushing. That's a phenomenal story. I was going to ask about self-care, like during that time, I don't know if you had even a thought about how to make sure you're taking care of yourself or that your husband was taking care of himself or was that?
Yeah, I know, you know, it's kind of one of those things because I obviously, you know, I'm sure at some capacity, possibly, I will say this, what ended up happening, which I was very fortunate for, like looking back, when Ryan had gotten really sick with the same thing many years prior and I had just had Henry. So Henry was literally like 3 days old. And so we were kind of dealing with all of that. And I remember calling my primary care doctor and just saying, I don't think I can do this. I don't think I can do this. I'm, you know, 3 days postpartum. My husband's in the hospital. Like, I can't do this. Can you just prescribe me something so I can get through the day? And I remember my PCP telling me, I haven't seen you in over a year. No, you can come in. And we'll talk about this. And it pissed me off. And I thought, here I am reaching out for help just because I don't think I can make it through another day. And you turn me down. And so, and I'm not saying that was the solution. And so that just added fuel to my fire. And I'm like, I don't need anything anyways. I'm going to handle it on my own. And so this time around, I had just had Austin, of course. And I placed an after hours call to my OB and just said, I have to be able to like get through this. Like I have to be able to be mellow and calm. And I have all my hormones are raging. And I don't know what I'm feeling. I don't even feel what I'm feeling, you know? And so my OB was phenomenal. And my OB just said, nope, you tell me what you need. Because the other piece was my milk supply was so down because I was so stressed.
Yes.
So there was a lot of like, for me, I was more irritated too that I couldn't even be able to nurse the baby. And so I called her with all this and said, this is how I feel. And now I'm raging because I want my milk up. Mm-hmm. And so she just said, I don't think it's a good idea to introduce, you know, an antidepressant and increase your milk supply. I would want you to do one or the other. I will prescribe both, but I want you to pick one or the other. And so I said, great, I'm taking the milk supply because that if I can nurse him, I'm going to feel mentally stable. Yes. And that's what happened.
Yeah.
And so, and it wasn't, and I actually didn't even end up using anything with the antidepressant. And if someone does, more power to you. I'm super excited because it's a need in some cases. But for me mentally, I just needed to know that I could provide for the baby.
Yeah.
And, but she listened to me and she was like, absolutely, whatever you need, here you go. Uh-huh. And so that probably was one piece of self-care that I looked at pretty quickly on, and I didn't let it go past, you know, a couple days of being in the hospital because I knew this was going to be a battle for sure.
Right. Oh, that's great again that you can recognize that that was something that was upsetting or stressing you out and seek out a solution for yourself. So how important it is as you're taking care of your family and Henry,
right,
that you could acknowledge, I need this for myself too. So
right,
good, great bit of Brittany that you could do that. yeah, I mean, that's, wow, just a remarkable story. And is there any other piece of advice you could give another mom or dad in a similar situation?
I know. I mean, as a parent, I think it's difficult. And I think one of the things that was really, really difficult for me is, and it's just our experience. I can't say this is across the board, but it's a really lonely world to be in that PICU, right? So you know that you have a lot of children that are critical. And I remember this family coming in next to us, and they were in the room right next to us, and the mom looked like a zombie, the dad looked like a zombie, and they had probably about a 10-month-old baby, and then they had a 2.5, 3-year-old. So almost the same kind of boat of us. And, you know, our doctors really wouldn't share much, and so I had just said something to the fact, because we saw them all the time, and but yet we didn't ever talk to each other. And so I had asked the hematologist, I just said, is their little girl going to be okay? And she said, it's going to be a very long road for them. We're going to start chemo with them next week. So they're going to move out of here and then they're going to go to the chemo wing. And I just said, oh my God, like that sucks. Like I just remember being like, God, that sucks. She's got a 10-month-old, she's got almost a 3-year-old, and this little girl's like, couldn't move, and you know, and she ended up having bone cancer and leukemia on top of it. She just got hit with everything. And so I just thought, God, that's horrible. And then we got released and we went and started to live our life, and then we got put back in. And then I kind of was envious of them because I'm like, they got their diagnosis and we still don't have our diagnosis. Right. You know, so they're living their life now knowing what to expect, and we're still stuck in this yucky, lonely place. And I think that's the piece, like when you're a parent, like you are in this lonely world and people don't want to talk. Like, you know, we ended up getting put on the chemo wing of sides, and none of those parents wanted to interact. None of them wanted to talk. They were so hyper-focused on their child. And I think that would be the piece, like the piece would be, it would have just been nice to be able to connect with somebody, you know, and maybe not another parent that was in that same stage right there, but I don't know, like a support person or somebody that had been there, or a parent that had been there and have moved past it so they could be like a light for you, you know, because I just felt it was just super dark, super lonely and nobody would engage. And we had some really great friends that one night brought us like silly amount of food, like 6 things of pizza. And I thought, oh my gosh, there's no way, you know, we're going to go through this. So Ryan and I, we obviously gave it to all the nurses, the doctors, everybody. We just kind of fed, and then we would go room to room to knock and say, we have pizza. Do you guys want some? And really, like, everyone just kind of looked at us and nope, nope, nope. We had one family that took us up on it, the family I was talking about. And that's how we kind of started discussing her treatment, you know? And so that kind of bridged the gap a little bit. But yeah, it was just, it's hard, you know? It's hard and it's lonely. And I think that's the piece. I think when you're in it, you just want to fall victim and be like, oh, why me? Why is this happening? Like, this is so dark. This is the worst thing that's happening.
Yes.
But I just think that you have to also be a light and be like, there's got to be something that's going to good can come out of it. There's got to be something like, this is, you're not going to always be in this dark spot. So yeah.
Right. That's interesting. I don't know. I'm trying to think of some ideas here as I'm listening to you of what could possibly, you know, be kind of grown organically.
Yeah.
That. I don't know. Even like having some people that's on a list of a phone triage to be able to call or reach out to, or something that, like you said, who've been there, who,
I think that'd be fantastic. And I think that's the piece where we got fortunate because I reached out on all these Facebook groups, right? So, you know, I'm part of a hereditary spherocytosis because that's what we thought he had. I'm part of a PNH because that's what we thought he had. I'm part of an AHOS group because that's what we thought he had. And that was really my outlet, you know, because I could get on and like pick the brains of all these parents and connect with them on a different level. And so that aspect for me was huge. And obviously here, I mean, you have to worry about HIPAA and all that stuff. And, you know, so I know that their hands are tied on certain things.
Right.
But yeah, man, it was, when we were given the terminal diagnosis, I jumped on the AHOS group and asked to see who's in Colorado, because it's so rare. And sure enough, I found a Colorado family that was being treated by the same doctors, and they were up in Longmont, and they came down and they met with us in Henry's room.
Wow.
And they sat with us, and they just let both of, like, you know, her daughter and the mom, and we just drilled them with questions.
Yeah.
And asked, and they were so loving and so open and talked to us about everything. Mm-hmm. And you know, I asked them, like, do you like your care? Do you like this doctor? Like, you know, and so they honestly gave us a lot of reassurance in the doctors.
Yes.
But the biggest thing for us was when they left, Ryan and I looked at each other and said, Henry doesn't have this.
Uh-huh.
And we knew. And just being able to talk to another family who's living it, who's had different experience,
sure.
We knew that's not what our son had.
Sure.
And so, yeah, so that piece for me was huge. So yeah, if you're able to connect people or share stories or something to that effect, gosh, I think it would just do everybody so much good, you know? And they were they were great people, you know, and positive, and they gave us hope too, you know? Their daughter's terminal and she's done all this. I mean, they were giving us tips on Make-A-Wish. And so it was just kind of like, oh my God, I'm not ready for this, you know?
But still,
but it was great, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. And anybody out there listening want to chime in about ways to connect families in the hospital? I know in the Denver Special Needs Play Group, a lot of times the moms will say, hey, I'm going to be in the hospital these dates. Do you want to come down or want to get some coffee? But even more like, not necessarily so immediate, even just to be able to reach out and have that community is important.
It is important. And yeah, we're a part of the special needs group too. And that was how part with our home giver when we got Henry's home giver. It was a valuable tool to have and say, hey, have you guys used this company? What do you think? Like, oh, you know, and just being able to interact with somebody that's in that same boat as you, because you will always have people that will offer to help, and you're always gonna have people that say really stupid things. And you're kind of just left like, you know? And so when you are doing life with people that are in your same shoes, it makes the biggest difference.
Absolutely. That is a great thing about social media, that we can have access to that. Well, anything else you'd like to share, Brittany?
No. I mean, I would just say, you know, it's my personality, so it's obviously easy for me to say, like, stand up, fight, don't take no. But I also know, like, that's not how God made us, right? God didn't make everybody to have that personality. And so I would just say, if you know that is not your personality, or you know that it's really hard for you to have confrontation or question or any of that, find somebody that you can partner with, that you can have these feelings, you can share your intuition, and then let somebody else also be a voice for you. And, you know, they do, I mean, we had a social worker in the hospital, and I literally was down there every single day, and I'd be like, I don't like this, I don't like this. I mean, there were certain nurses I would refuse to let Henry get a blood draw from, because it was excruciating, you know? And so I didn't have to say that to the nurse, but I said that to the nurse's manager. Social worker put me in charge. And so that was like another good thing. Like, it was just, you know what you like and you know what you don't like, and don't think you're going to hurt somebody's feelings. I mean, we had a couple nurses that were not allowed to come back in our room, you know, and I don't care. Cause it was a tough go, you know? So no, it's not going to happen again. So
yeah. Well, you guys are your best advocates for your son. No one else is going to advocate.
No, absolutely.
And
yeah.
You guys are healthcare consumers. You have the right to choose your healthcare provider.
Right.
And those are things that people don't know. And so wonderful that you guys were able to stand up for him. And gosh darn it, as a physical therapist, if somebody doesn't like what I'm doing, I'm grateful for them to tell me.
Right.
Because it not only affects your child or that person, but other people that I may not even be aware of that. So I welcome that feedback.
No, I agree. And that's the thing too. And I do believe we're very relational people, right? And so Henry had a physical therapist prior to this, because he had some delays in other aspects. And, you know, she was also a great resource, and she was, you know, and that, I think she might've been the one to tell me, hey, go talk to the social worker. There's a social worker there. And I'm like, what? Like, I didn't know. Like, I mean, they don't like come to you, like you're checking into a hotel and say, these are all the amenities we have.
Right.
You know, it's still kind of like a secret world, you know?
Absolutely.
So yeah. So I think that's the piece. So use the resources you have, use the relationships you have, and see if you can help, you know, add a couple, you know, pieces to that puzzle, you know?
Absolutely. No, that's great. One thing about that, I think it's, even though you're not an expert in the field, I think sometimes that is the key, because when you are so laser focused as a specialist, as a kidney specialist or as a whatever, you are so tight in that area alone, and our bodies don't work that way.
Right.
We had a kidney problem because everything else was shutting down.
Right. Right.
That's what got the, so when we change lenses and we look at it from a different way,
absolutely.
So that, you know, I think that also shows how we as just lay people or non-specialists have something to say.
I totally agree. I think everybody is valuable in their own world, you know? And so if we can just honestly communicate and share it, we're going to have better results.
Yes, and that's another great point too. With all of our electronic medical records, you would think that would be so easy.
You would think, yeah.
Yeah, and that's not the case. I've worked in hospitals and rehab centers, and you are absolutely right. Nobody is reading each other's notes.
No.
And so your meeting that you called, that was something that wasn't asked for by the doctors, that you took in charge. I think that, like you said, was a turning point and something I would absolutely recommend people follow, because you hit it on the head that they have to be talking to each other in the same room, and all the ideas coming forth, not just in their own silos, which happens too often.
Well, you know what I actually think was kind of funny is they actually had to prepare for it.
Yeah.
And so if nothing else, and as selfish as this sounds, it made him focus on my son.
Sure.
And as a parent, that's what I wanted. I just wanted them to pay a little bit more attention to what was going on before they had to answer to us.
Absolutely.
And so, and I know they have other patients, but they all came to that meeting prepared. Like, they were prepared. So I'm like, goodness, if nothing else, it made them sit down and try to figure this out and come with me with solutions. So.
Well, your son is no less valuable than anybody else's son. And
right, true.
Providing 100% attention to everyone. If not,
I agree.
Hire more staff.
Right.
You know, I mean, our caseload should not determine the quality of care we provide.
Absolutely.
Brittany, it was a pleasure talking with you.
Of course. It's always a pleasure as well with you. So thank you so much for letting us share our story.
Yes. And I will absolutely get in touch with you and we'll discuss things. We shouldn't take so long between our discussions.
No worries. Well, thank you so much. Have a great rest of your day. And I appreciate chatting with you about Henry.
All right, Brittany, take care.
All right. Bye-bye.